Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, with occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Judy Bartopinka, Democrat Tom Scheer, and tax watchdog Ralph Martiri. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base on the Sirius XM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where President Obama is in town as we speak, hopefully listening to the broadcast this evening on the eve of President's Day. That is his first President's Day, which America will celebrate tomorrow, first President's Day as president. And no doubt he is celebrating his first big legislative victory last week, a $787 billion stimulus package, unlike anyone ever known before. Even though it passed without Republican support, he comes back to his hometown and again, what is dominating news in his own hometown, but the local politics again. For those listening around the country, news broke really about 24 hours ago involving the senator-elect, Barack Obama's replacement in the Senate, Roland Burris. There's controversy swirling around him as to whether or not he told all of the truth under oath before the House impeachment panel in Springfield, and whether or not there were any questionable conversations that took place with members of Governor Rod Blagojevich's staff about any exchange of money that may or may not have taken place to get him into the U.S. Senate seat. It's a brewing story here in Illinois. We'll talk briefly about it at a time. And again, we will be talking about the economic stimulus package. But again, it did once again sort of rain on Barack Obama's parade when he came back to Chicago. And we'll be taking calls at 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. Tom Scheer is our Democrat. Tom, nice to have you with us.
Good to be back.
Again, speak to the issue of the president coming home. It's his first time back in Chicago, and once again, he looks to the front pages of the papers, and it's a local story that has national implications.
He couldn't even enjoy his quiet dinner with his wife at one of the local restaurants last night. He was at Art Smith's restaurant trying to have a nice time. You know, it's funny. I listened to you mention to people that we're going to be talking about the stimulus package, and that's the biggest story nationally, and this is a big thing happening in Illinois, this Burris controversy, and I'll tell you, I think it's of importance to the entire country, because he is a United States senator. There are only 100 of them. You'd like them to tell the truth, and it doesn't matter what anyone in this studio thinks about whether Roland Burris committed perjury or not. We don't have to even offer an opinion. Roland Burris has confirmed that he committed perjury. He won't use those words, but his affidavit directly contradicts what he had said in his sworn statement on January 5th. That he didn't, not he had contact with one person is what he said. He had contact with other people, one of whom asked him for $10,000. He didn't give the money, but that's not the point. The point is, did he tell the truth? And I think it's a very clear no. And I'm a Democrat. Doesn't have to be Democrat or Republican. Truth is truth.
Judy Bartopinka is our Republican tonight. She ran for governor. She lost to Governor Rod Blagojevich.
I love all those tainted dollars.
So we want to stress that to those listening around the country that may not know your name instantly. But again, your reaction to this ongoing saga of the U.S. Senate seat and how Roland Burris got it.
Well, first of all, I agree with Tom. It's perjury. I mean, it's just plain. This is the third version of what he thought he said, or you know, and the committee is saying that both Republicans and Democrats, they all want to look into it. I just sin by omission here. He just happened to not think about it. But then you think of Chicago politics in general and how they operate, and things that come out the swamp, things that come out of the Chicago swamp, always have stuff you know still stuck to the bottoms of their feet.
And, but he did choose to sign an affidavit and send it back to Barbara Flynn Curry, who was the head of the impeachment panel that mm-hmm. that initially led to the charges
in Illinois.
So, in Illinois,
right?
So he there was some initiative on his part to sort of set the record straight. And basically he said that in responding to questions before the House Impeachment Committee, when he looked at them, he felt that maybe he could have told a little more than he did initially.
Well, I watched his press conference today, and he was thrashing around trying to make it all come together. And it wasn't coming together very well, frankly. But just because he sent this material in, at some point, all of these folks that are involved with former Governor Blagojevich are going to wind up in grand juries. They're going to have to give testimony. Someone is going to say they talked to Roland Burris. and offered him money. Whether he took it or not is immaterial. So that's going to flush out at some point.
Well, we don't know that. Also, that's a reach there. That's a reach.
Folks, let me introduce our third guest, who's Ralph Martiri. He is bipartisan. He usually takes sides in any fights other than strong discussions and opinions on tax policy. But you're also a longtime Illinois resident. You watch the ebb and flow of politics in this state. Your reaction to the new controversy involving the junior senator from Illinois?
You know, my reaction is what anyone from Illinois' reaction would be. We should be talking about the big stuff, like the stimulus package. Very exciting to talk about. Will it create jobs and all that? But in Illinois, we can't. We can't because another politician has done something that may be underhanded and seems to have gotten caught at it. And in this state, it seems like we can't get to big issues too often because of some sort of chicanery. And really, it's frustrating. Now, whether Roland Burris honestly remembered this stuff later or not, the timing is pretty questionable. I mean, why didn't he have this sudden recollection while the hearings were still going on before he got confirmed, et cetera, et cetera? And I think the natural question most people are going to ask, and it's a logical question, is was he really concerned that something had been caught on tape and it would come out later?
That's the only conclusion I can draw is he came up with this affidavit because he wanted to get out ahead of it because he knew that this would be disclosed later.
Well,
we
should also mention those listening around the country. Again, it was also on the front page of the Chicago Sun-Times today. They broke it on their website yesterday. So he was really reacting, and he reacted this afternoon. About 2 hours ago, he held a press conference, a Sunday afternoon press conference, and the junior senator from Illinois, Roland Burris, responded and denied any wrongdoing insofar as his conversations about the Senate seat with Governor Rod Blagojevich.
Rod Blagojevich reached out to me in three separate phone calls to ask for assistance raising money for his brother, then Governor Blagojevich. A fact that I fully disclosed in my affidavit to the impeachment committee. I made it very clear to him that I would not contribute, that it would be inappropriate and a major conflict because I'd expressed an interest in the Senate seat. Once more, I've always conducted myself with honor and integrity. We have provided information to the impeachment committee as well as Senators Reed and Durbin, and I did not donate one single dollar, nor did I raise any money or promise any favors of any kind.
Judy Bartopinka, no money was exchanged hands. Does that change anything about his story?
No, not at all, because the intention and the way the criminal law reads is always out there.
Well, intention by whom, though? Let's just clarify. This was intent by Blagojevich's brother, Rob.
Rob, but he was his finance. He was his finance director, and this was
Rob
all part Rob
Blagojevich,
right. You know, brother of the former governor. And so that's all part and parcel. They were all in this huge make money type thing, which had to get done very quickly because the law was going to change in Illinois.
And you're wondering, Bruce,
not allow it.
I'm just trying to clarify.
We've got a pause. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. When we come back, we'll hear Republican leadership response to the allegations that Roland Burris may have acted improperly in getting the Senate seat offered to him by former Governor Rod Blagojevich. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back shortly. From Seattle, Washington to Boston, Massachusetts, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, coast to coast and border to border on America's great radio stations, as well as XM Satellite Radio. Ralph Martiri is here. He came here to talk about taxes and the stimulus package, which we are going to talk about before the program goes off this evening, actually in a matter of moments. But you wanted to make a point about this, about the current controversy involving Roland Burris, the junior senator from Illinois.
Yeah, it seems like most of Roland's rebuttal in today's press conference focused on the facts that no money changed hands. He was clear he was not going to get into the money thing. And really, that wasn't the issue. The issue is whether or not Roland, our senator, was straightforward with the impeachment committee or whether or not he lied to them and concealed information he knew they wanted to find out about.
One person who has a very strong opinion on that joins us now. He is Tom Cross. He is a veteran Republican lawmaker. He is also the House, Illinois House Republican Minority Leader. And, Tom, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
What is your reaction, and when did you first hear the news about this other affidavit that had been filed with your colleague, the Majority Leader, Barbara Flynn Curry?
Apparently, well, we found out about it through a Chicago newspaper, the Sun-Times, yesterday morning. They posted it online for a Sunday story, so this was, which was the 14th. So I'm told that the date of it is somewhere either the 4th or the 5th. I've yet to see it, but clearly the Barbara had it for anywhere from a week to 10 days and has never told us about it.
In the course, for those listening around the country, in the course of the investigation of Rod Blagojevich between the House and Republican members in Illinois and then the subsequent trial that took place in the state Senate, would you say that the relations, both Republicans and Democrats, during that period of time was one of bipartisanship where everybody was getting along with each other?
Yes.
And so does this, the fact that Barbara Flynn Curry did not make this information available to you, have you had any conversation with her about why she did not share that?
She called Jim Durkin today and asked what we were up to today, but no, we have not had any conversation with her. I'm puzzled still to this day why a critical piece of evidence on a specific question that Jim Durkin asked probably about a month ago, I don't know the exact date, I think maybe it was January 8th, and to which Roland said no to some specific questions, and then he contradicts that with this affidavit, you would think that she would share that with the committee, or at least pick up the phone and call Jim and say, I got this affidavit, you ought to know about it, I'm not sure how we're going to handle it, do you have any ideas?
Tom,
none of that.
Tom, to the layperson, listening and watching this broadcast this evening, they assume that when you go before a hearing, you raise your right hand and you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. But they also know by watching, crime dramas on television, that sometimes when you are responding to a question, you stop short. You don't let all of your information out. In retrospect, could that be used as a defense by Roland Burris in this particular case? Because he basically said that he thought that he had basically told one story, and then when he looked at it in writing, he felt that he warranted and had a responsibility to tell more, which then caused the affidavit to be written, which then went to Barbara Flynn Curry, upon which we now have a big brewing story.
Well, the question that Durkin asked him was about as specific as you can get. Did you have any conversations with Rob Blagojevich, the governor's brother? Did you have conversations with Harris, Schofield, Wyman, et cetera? And he said, well, I think I had a conversation. I did have a conversation with Lon Monk. Remember, let's also put this in context of what else was going on. He was basically, I don't want to say ordered, but Harry Reid said, we're not going to seat you into the United States Senate until you go before the House Impeachment Committee and clear the air. That's my term. Clear the air over the fact that, the governor had been trying to sell a Senate seat, not necessarily with Mr. Burris, but with others. So remember the context of what this was all about. And so it's a pretty significant day. It's a pretty significant bit of testimony. And to say, when you're asked, I only met with Lon Monk, and we find out now he had three conversations with Rob Blagojevich, it's a little puzzling what was going through his mind.
Tom, in your view, does this disqualify Roland Burris from serving as a United States Senator?
Well, to back up, I never thought he should have taken the appointment. I think there should have been a special election. I think there still should be a special election. I don't think in the circumstances in which he was appointed it was right. We are trying to take to the degree we can, take the politics out of this. I don't think this investigation, the impeachment committee, can do a hearing. I don't think they have any power to go after perjury or contempt. I think it needs to be conducted by an outside independent group, and that can be the state's attorney of Sangamon County. I guess it could be the appellate prosecutor's office as well, but I think we need to take it out of the realm of the legislature.
Is there any way that you feel the United States Senate should review their action?
Well, they were the ones that sent him to this committee. And they're the ones that said, you know, as I said, you got to kind of get over this hurdle. And clearly the hurdle, he got over it because he said one thing. I'm not so sure if the things contained in the latest affidavit wouldn't have caused a little pause for Harry Reid. And I think that's going to be up to Harry Reid how he handles that. I certainly have no control over it, but I would think they'd start to ask some questions.
Now, we should also mention, for those listening around the country, there is another national name that people are familiar with. That is the number two Democrat in the United States Senate. It's Dick Durbin. He is the senior senator from Illinois. Immediately following the arrest of the governor and his chief of staff, John Harris, he was the one that basically went forward and said that the United States Senate would not seat anyone appointed by Rod Blagojevich. There was then a letter signed by the Democratic senators basically solidifying that. You then had Harry Reid going way out on the limb saying basically no way they were going to take anybody who was appointed by Rod Blagojevich. And so you had a situation where during the course of about 3 or 4 weeks, everybody started to buckle and sort of back away from a very strong argument that was being made and almost a singular voice by the members of the United States Senate. And now you have a situation where the senior senator, Dick Durbin, he's traveling around the world in Turkey and Greece. So he basically said, I'm not going to be back in the United States until next Friday when I can respond to it. So he is comfortably away from the circumstance, which seems to me, which gets back to what I said at the very beginning of the program, it sort of puts the issue right back on the president of the United States to have to respond to a political mess in his own backyard.
Well, it's a huge problem for him. And, of course, Bruce, one of our concerns is why did the Democrats in Springfield sit on this for 9 days this is a way for Mr. Burris to come clean, Senator Burris, and yet he only gives it to one person who puts it basically under her desk and says, "Oh, I'd forgotten about it. I'm not sure. I didn't even know I'd gotten it, et cetera, for different accounts." This was that important to clear the air. Why not hold a press conference? Why not go to Harry Reid? Why not go to the members of the impeachment committee and say, "Here's what's going on. I made a mistake."
Well, Tom Cross, what will happen next insofar as the Illinois House is concerned on further action on this matter?
Well, I think this committee needs to convene maybe one more time and ask the Democrats, is there anything else you've accumulated over the last month? We'd like to know, what were the circumstances surrounding this affidavit. And let's turn this over to an independent body like the Sangamon County State's Attorney's Office and move on.
And by the way, we should remind people listening around the country that when the Illinois House voted, there was only one vote that voted against the impeachment, or at least moving the impeachment articles to the state Senate. That is the sister-in-law of then-Governor Rod Blagojevich. Yeah. And in the Illinois State Senate, when conviction came down, it was 59-0. So a number of Democrats, both in the Senate and House, appear to have wanted, they want to get Rod Blagojevich, off the table. And now, once again, given the controversy stirred up by the Chicago Sun-Times and the affidavits, and who knew about the affidavits when, again, this issue is going to jump back onto the front pages of not only papers in Illinois tomorrow, but and certainly fodder for the national cable talk shows, is once again, Roland Burris, who was, 2 months ago, a relatively obscure national political figure, once again is thrust back into the national headlines at a time when we're dealing with much bigger, broader issues of a huge stimulus package. But Tom Cross, thank you very much for sharing your insight into how this story came down and what's likely to happen next.
Thanks, Bruce. Hope you guys have a great show. I appreciate being on.
Thank you. That's Tom Cross. He is the Illinois House Republican leader and offering his comments in case you've not heard the news. The press conference this afternoon by Illinois Senator Roland Burris denying any wrongdoing. He basically said that he was just trying to provide more affidavit, another affidavit, more information, and we'll give everybody one last shot. Judy Bart Topinka, you don't buy it at all.
Well, first of all, I didn't realize that the Democrats in the House have been sitting on this thing for 9 days. I think that's inexcusable. That should have been put forward right away in a bipartisan fashion as that impeachment committee was designed to do. I mean, just plain simple and all that. how many other potential affidavit problems are out there with Roland Burris? I mean, he has to be called back in and say, what else do you know? And, I mean, then go back ultimately to Rod Blagojevich, who's not going to go down, obviously, by himself and wants company. So I suspect there's going to be a lot of names yet to be floating around.
Tom Scheer, final word to you.
That may be wishful thinking on the Republican stalwarts part. I don't know how deep this thing goes. There's no question that Burris didn't tell the truth when he was asked very clearly. But one thing that sticks with me, we've heard the name Barack Obama, President Obama, in this discussion tonight. And if I'm Barack Obama and if I'm even a bipartisan view of this thing, why should he bear the burden of this? You know, Chicago has produced some wonderful public servants. One of them's in the White House right now. Pat Quinn is the governor, a great man. Alexi DeNulius, a real up-and-comer. These are Democrats. Wonderful Republicans have been produced by the Chicago political environment. The problem is you get these bad guys or people who make mistakes like Burris, and then this is what you get.
We've got a pause. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. 1-800-723-8289. It's nice to have you with us. We're having a little fun during the break. It'll be in my memoirs. Someday you're going to talk about whatever happened on February 15th on the show. Well, there'll be maybe a chapter on it. But let me just reintroduce our guest. Our Democrat tonight is Tom Scheer. Tom is a media consultant, a former talk show host, and he also is a card-carrying Democrat, so he joins us wearing that banner proudly this evening. Judy Bartipinka is our Republican. She is a longtime member of the political Republican glitterati in the state of Illinois. She ran for governor against Rod Blagojevich. She lost. However, she was state treasurer for three terms and also was a longtime member of the state Senate and before that a reporter.
I was in the House, too.
And you were in the House and also a reporter. So you've been
done it all.
And you've been watching banks and bankers and in your role as state treasurer. So you'll have some interesting things to say when we talk about our primary story tonight, and that is the $787 billion stimulus package. And also joining us is the executive director, Ralph Martiri. He is the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability, and that is a national organization based in Illinois, and they look at whether taxpayers are being handled properly. And let me get your first response, Ralph, because you've got great credentials on looking at all things fiscal. What is your take on what Congress did last week?
Well, you know, first off, we're in favor of a stimulus package, so we think that they did the right thing by acting. I think this is a unique economic time, number one. Number two, you do get a bigger bang out of your buck for direct expenditures at the federal level. So we would have preferred to have seen more on the spending side and less on the tax break side, and particularly less on the tax break side for businesses, because that hasn't worked. I mean, if you look at our two biggest poor job performances in a presidential administration, you have the Reagan administration and George W. Bush, period. And those were our big business tax cutters. It really hasn't worked, and so we'd like to see less of it. Overall, I think going forward, Barack Obama's administration has done everything they can out of the box. But there are some troubling things he's inherited in addition to this mess, and they go to the overall budget deficit. I mean, right now, federal debt is over $10 trillion. Our national economy is only $14 trillion. Interest on our debt last year was about $240 billion. That's more than our discretionary budget for education, housing, urban development, human services, and environmental protection combined. So we have some big issues to clean up at the federal level, but on this exact package, we certainly are in favor of it, and we do think it'll create jobs. We actually agree with the number. The 3.5 million number thrown around is relatively accurate.
Judy Bartipinka, again, state treasurer, you watched state funds, for 16 years and also in the General Assembly. What's your reaction to the federal stimulus package, and is it really needed?
Yeah, I think it's needed. I think we have to have a stimulus. Something has to give. You have to do something. Nothing is not acceptable. I must admit that the sheer numbers of what's involved here is scary to me as one who always likes to pay bills and is very, very touchy about spending money and what do you get for it.
Now you're known as a cheapskate.
Oh yeah, as I said, I had a hard time getting over here tonight, passing the Goodwill thrift shop. It was like, should I stop early and not come by? You know, but it bothers me that this is going to have to be paid at some point. I mean, this isn't just free money. Where is it coming from? I think people ask that question. Where are you getting this money? Where is this borrowing coming from?
Does it bother you?
Yes.
As a Republican, I want to ask a political question.
Okay.
Because, again, I think most people say that they expected government to do something.
Yes.
They may not like what they've done, but they wanted some action. Does it bother you as a Republican that only three members of the United States Senate support this package?
Frankly, on the one hand, yes. But on the other hand, I would have liked to have seen more involvement and acceptance by Republican ideas here. When we ultimately look in terms of, again, the payoff, somebody's got to pay this. Grandchildren, children down the road, generations down the road, a $33,000 hit basically per person that this is going to cost. You're bored and you're already in the hole. You have to do something.
But insofar,
I don't know that I have an alternative.
But insofar as involvement is concerned.
Yeah. I think we should have had more Republicans on
here. It is the president. The president said he wanted bipartisan support, and he's got
three votes. And I honor him for doing that, for reaching out and attempting to do that. He is holding fast with what he ran on.
But at the end of the day, philosophies are philosophies. And the Republicans wanted 2.5 times more tax cuts than are in this package. And we all know the supply-side economics do not work. David Stockman, let's go find him, Reagan's budget director. He said that early in the Reagan administration before the president took him out to the woodshed and said, stop saying that. So at some point, if Obama and his people, the Democrats in this case, have this philosophy and the Republicans have that philosophy, bipartisanship isn't nearly as possible as we'd all like to see.
The president want?
He wanted to have his cake and eat it too, and he learned you usually can't get it. But he still got a major piece of legislation passed on the 40th or 41st day of his administration. It took Bill Clinton 7 months, took Ronald Reagan 8 or 9 months, or Bush, rather, 8 or 9 months. So, you know, it's pretty impressive that he got it through, but I think that's what he learned. Bruce, he wanted to have his cake and eat it too. It was an earnest effort by an earnest man, and I think this is a little bit of finding your legs as president.
You know, Judy, what bothers me is this as well, is that ultimately all of these things are supposed to be somewhat temporary, to be a stimulus. Stimulus means now. Many of these things are not going to come to pass for a year or 2 years. That's not a stimulus. Second of all, you're putting in programs that ultimately will become perpetual. They're not going to be temporary. Once you give something, you know, to the public, you lock in, it's going to be a program. So down the road, you have just grown government to the point where it's going to be more expensive to the tune of trillions of dollars.
Ralph, let me just ask one follow-up, because one of the things that there's been a lot of discussion on is the fact that a lot of these stimulus dollars are going to be backloaded. They're many years down the road. Just speak to the issue of the timing of when this money will start flowing and we'll be able to see something.
Well, we're going to see some immediate stimulus money from unemployment insurance expansion, health care expansion, the things that are going to go into public education, relief for the states. That's huge, because if state governments cut back their spending during a recession, it makes the recession far longer and deeper and cost you far more jobs. And so any sort of relief that goes into the state, you get a multiplier at the low end of 1.3 for every dollar spent by the state government through the stimulus package. Your local economy get a multiplier 1.3, at the worst, some cases 1.5, 1.7. But to get to the long-term timing, I agree that if all they were looking for was to head off a potential little recession, you'd want a short-term, targeted, narrow package. It's absolutely what you'd want. That's not what we're in. We are looking at a 2 or 3 year downturn in our economy. And so phasing out public investments on infrastructure over the next year to 2 years is very sensible and will actually help minimize this deep trough that we're throwing in. It's a unique situation, and it's not really a temporary stimulus package.
But infrastructure is usually a one-shot deal. It's done. You can prorate it over a number of generations, and it makes good sense. But now you're creating programs in terms of health care. You're creating programs in terms of unemployment comp and so on. Those things are going to go on way longer,
longer. Most of what's in the package is a one-time deal with a finite amount of time assigned to it. There are some things that are permanent, so to speak, could be.
They will
be.
But not
most of them, though, Judy.
But they, and the ones that will be permanent are going to be extremely expensive. They will be with us a long time, and so it goes.
I mean, you've just grown government. They won't be extremely expensive, even if they make the Medicaid increase in the matching rates permanent. Right? That's only going to cost about $86 billion over the next 5 years. That's not even a rounding error in the size of the stimulus,
if you think about it. And
health care is a major issue in this. We got to get some sensible approach to economic policy. And I think too much focus on philosophy has gotten us in this rut. It's like they say at the University of Chicago, that's fine in practice. How's it work in theory? We're ignoring the practice here. And the practice in America for the last 8 years of George W. Bush has been pretty simple. Ruinous tax cuts that have gone to business, significant shift in economic welfare from low and middle income families to more affluent families. So much so that 80% of America's workers have seen their incomes flat or declining for the last 8 years. 80%. And we have a negative savings rate. Meanwhile, corporate profits were the highest percentage of the gross domestic product in Bush's last year that they ever were, and wages were the lowest percentage.
We need to address that. How's that working for us?
So anything that's a long-term relief directed at people, I think, frankly, is more than needed in a better investment of our taxpayer
dollars.
I rather
like the part of putting the cap on executive salaries, bonuses. Oh, man, that was a good one. And yet that was fought. I couldn't understand why they fought that. They were trying to keep it out.
If we look at this $787 billion stimulus package, if we look at that and we're trying to look at when are we going to see and acknowledge that it's working, put that in context with the bank bailout that we've already had, the bank bailout that will be coming up, and anything that needs to be done to jumpstart the housing market above and beyond the stimulus package, doesn't the bank and credit issue have to be solved first?
That's the most important problem facing the country right now. Two issues: loosening credit, and what are we going to do about the bad debts, the mortgages mostly, that these banks are carrying on their books now? They haven't gone away. That's the biggest issue. You know, in the fifth year of the Reagan presidency.
But we don't know the answer to that question yet.
Right, because the first stimulus for the banks, or what's the word, the bailout, the TARP program, is almost done. There's only about $300 billion left in there, and there's a problem with where it's going to go.
And nobody really knows where it went or what it did and why it did nothing.
And we don't know how these issues. These are the two biggest issues, is what to do about the bad debts and loosening credit. And, you know, in year five of the Reagan presidency, year five, home interest rates were at nearly 11%. It was tough to get money, and it takes time.
Now, we should mention, Judy, that you're also, you've as state treasurer, you work with banks all over the state of Illinois, and also you serve on the board of a bank. So from a banker's perspective, how important is the next big decision coming out of Washington? And how badly can they either improve things or screw things up?
No, it's very important. I mean, the first round I thought was rather irresponsible because the money just went to banks. Why would you just give it to banks who sat on it? They certainly didn't put it into circulation. And the big banks bought medium-sized banks. The medium-sized banks bought little banks. And it was like the big fish eating their way on down the food chain. And it was ridiculous. And that's where we've left them.
I want to follow up. I want to get your response to that. 1-800-723-8029 from coast to coast and border to border. I'm Bruce Dumont. Your calls when we come back from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much. We'll go to calls 1-800-723-8029. After I mention something that is coming up, Judy Bartopink was kind enough many, many months ago to invite me to an upcoming event that her organization, the Riverside Republican Party, is putting together. It is the annual Lincoln Day Dinner, but it is long after Lincoln's birthday. But again, it's the Lincoln Day Dinner. It's coming up on Thursday night, this coming Thursday, February 19th. It's $25 a person. It's 6:30. It's at Clem's Banquet Hall in Lyons, Illinois. And if you would like to attend, all you have to do is give them a call at 708-351-0349. That's 708-351-0349. And I've been asked to be the featured speaker.
Ta-da!
So I'll bring my vacation slides and we'll talk about it. Mm-hmm. And by the way, for those listening around the country and around the state, I mean, I go to both Republican and Democratic events. And if the Democrats want to invite me someplace, I will go and chat with them as well. But again, it's the Riverside Republicans and Judy Bartopinka, and I'll look forward to being there on Thursday night. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Kathy. She's calling from Peru, Illinois. Go ahead.
Hello, panel. Okay, I'm willing to roll my shirt sleeves up, okay, and do work. But this time I think the Republicans put it out there when they voted no, except for the three, that they were saying we're against the working man and woman. I'm for this stimulus package. I want to see the sewers fixed here in our little town of Peru and Depew, Illinois, and LaSalle, and roadways fixed. But when you're saying, no, that doesn't matter, that sends a bad light. And I'm glad to hear that Judy says she's for people going to work. I think the Republicans are going to lose credibility. You know what? If there's two Republicans, we've got two empty bedrooms here. Come on down. Two of them, they're in the Illinois legislature or D.C. Come on down, stay at our house for 15 days, working days, and help out the city of Peru fill their potholes and everything, and that would show them that they would not vote no again on anything, because they would go, oh, my God, real work, we have to
Kathy,
do it.
Kathy, what do you say, I'm going to ask you, and then I want to ask Tom Scheer, our Democrat,
okay.
What do you say to those Republicans who just heard what you just said and say that there's a difference between the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, and if you are a Republican, you have certain principles, and if a piece of legislation comes down that you don't agree with, you shouldn't just vote for it because you want to be liked, because you may philosophically disagree with it. What's wrong with standing up for your principles?
Well, okay, there you said it, your principles. This is putting people to work, okay? We need to put our people back to work.
But some Republicans will argue that this isn't really going to do that.
Oh, it's going to.
That is your opinion. I want to get Tom's response to the sharp edge of the politics here.
The politics is the most disappointing aspect of this, because you can't tell me there were no members of the House of Representatives of the United States who voted for this bill. There were three members, no Republican members in the House who voted for it.
Right.
There were only three Republican senators who voted for it. You can't tell me that all those other Republicans, every single one of them, did not agree with this package. I think those who would have been inclined.
I just told you they did.
They fell into lockstep.
And I'll tell you, not only did they do it, last week, but if you turn back the clock to 1993, you mentioned Bill Clinton's economic package. There wasn't a Republican that supported Bill Clinton's economic package.
You're
as
right.
Well.
And
You're Rush right. Limbaugh was out there. He was shaking the bushes in 1993.
Who?
Rush Limbaugh
Rush
was
Limbaugh.
Out there.
Oh, the comedian.
He was shaking the bushes.
Yeah.
And a lot of the Republicans fell in behind that. And look what happened. What happened? With all those Republicans that voted against it in 93, Ralph, what happened?
Well,
it passed.
They passed, but they also did a pretty good job in the 94 election coming out and using it as a political hammer. But I'm going to say something else. How many of these Republicans that voted against Barack Obama's proposed stimulus package voted for TARP? How many of them voted for that bailout? Now, that's a bailout that gave $400 billion to nine banks.
Yeah, that's
taxpayer
excuse
money
Ugh.
To nine banks Ugh. With no countem zero strings. In fact, Dana Perino, the former press secretary, when asked about no credit being freed up, et cetera, well, we're hoping that's what they'll do. Hope? You show up at the table with $300 billion large, you know what you can do? You can require. You can require what they're going to do with every red cent before you give it to them. And you could even have some heads roll. It was so lacking in any sense of accountability for any Republican who voted for that to not vote for this package is completely being disingenuous.
So that is
the general public.
If you were to make your list of the most irresponsible Republicans, the people that did that.
That's fair.
That on that list.
And you know what? Just from a standpoint of the Republican Party, you can't always say no. I mean, what is your alternative? And that is one of our failings. Certainly,
well,
in
the
Illinois,
Senate
Republicans,
the Senate Republicans had alternatives,
that's how
they got their bill changed.
That's right.
And they got virtually everything they asked for.
And it was effective.
And get to Judy's point right there, being effective. You want to be at the table if you actually care about our big national economic decline, and this is kind of a big national economic decline. Be at the table.
Sure.
Negotiate with the administration, and guess what? If you're at the table saying, I'll help you pass it if this, this, and this, you got a chance of getting this or this. You're at least at the table. You can modify the legislation. If all you're
But
also, don't you run into a little problem when the president goes to Caterpillar in Peoria, Illinois, and says, put pressure on Congressman Schock to support this because that's the only way your president said, your president of your company says that he's going to be able to save jobs. And then the president less than, 4 hours later says, that's not true. That's not what I said. I mean, that hurts the president's credibility, does it not?
Well, the other thing, too, while he's over at an earth-moving company, which basically makes its hay by exporting to countries that do earth-moving, like Colombia, and then you blow the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, and that's down the tubes, they need the money so that they'll buy our stuff.
Right. We've got to pause. Judy Bart Topink is our Republican. Tom Scheer is our Democrat. Ralph Martire, he is our tax expert. He's the executive director of the Center for Tax Budget Accountability. I'm Bruce Dumont. If you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. And if you're listening to us on radio, phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8255. 8289. Back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway. Tonight featuring commentary by Republican Judy Bar Topinka, Democrat Tom Scheer, and Ralph Martiri. He is the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. And if you know the name Ralph Martiri and say, didn't he used to be a band leader? Yes, he used to be a band leader, and he is a distant cousin of yours.
That is correct.
And you've answered your whole life, you've answered that question, haven't you?
My whole life since living in Chicago metropolitan area, yes.
Well, he was one of the great band leaders of all time. Our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. We're talking about the economic stimulus package, $787 billion. It is the biggest economic stimulus package in the history of the country. It is it passed, as you know, with no members of the House Republicans supporting it, and only three Republicans in the Senate: Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, and Susan Collins, and Olympia Snow of Maine, which is almost a Democratic state, so they can really vote whichever way they want and frequently rile up a lot of Republicans. But they were able to get at least a portion of the tax cuts in there. They expanded them. They cut some of the spending out of it, and so they got something by going to the table with the president. Let us now go to phones. Let's go to Monterey, California, where Mark is listening to us on KION. Nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway. Go ahead.
Hey, Bruce, thanks very much, and hi to Ralph. And I just wanted to say that your cousin's version of Caravan is one of the best ever.
Thank you very much. I'm sure if he were alive, he'd be happy to hear that.
You know, Bruce, I was telling your producer off the air that I had a chance to hear the lady from Peru, Illinois, talking about how she was in favor of the stimulus package. And I was really kind of sorry to hear that, because I think a lot of people don't understand that the outcome or the outgrowth of stimulus package spending is going to be rampant price inflation down the line. And I heard on one of the TV business news channels the other day that the Fed and the Treasury were going to monetize this debt. And if you look up debt monetization on the Internet, you will see that debt monetization leads to inflation. And when we're talking about the amount of money that we're dealing with in this package, we're looking at double-digit price inflation like what we had in the 1970s. And we know that inflation, Bruce, is so devastating to lower-income people, people on fixed incomes, and anyone in retirement, because it essentially destroys the value of their savings. So this stimulus package comes at a very heavy price for the American people. And furthermore, It's the Keynesian solution, and I think one of the things that people have to
Let's let Ralph respond to what you've said thus far, then
sure.
We'll go back to you.
Yeah, okay. I have two quick points to make. I think far more disastrous for low- and middle-income working families has been flat and declining wages over the last 20 years than anything inflation could do to them. I mean, their incomes are flat and declining. They're not being paid for working, and now they're losing work. They have nothing to lose as a savings standpoint because they haven't been able to save. Last year in America, our national savings rate was zero. Getting them to work and getting them an income is by far and away priority number one. Number two, I would agree that the traditional analysis is long-term, this could have an inflationary impact, but this is not a traditional time. We see in our private, and in particular financial markets and real estate markets, significant overvaluation of assets that have been in that system for the last few years, so much so that we now think they have to be written down by trillions of dollars. So this new spending is not going to be on top of a lively or decent base. It's actually more like replacement money coming in to bring values almost back to where we thought they were. It won't be inflationary.
Let's go to Brian in Aurora, Illinois, listening to us on our flagship station, WLS.
Hi, thanks, Bruce. Hi, guys. I just got a couple of quick questions or my concerns regarding this stimulus package. One, there is a heck of a lot of pork in here that no one seems to address, unless you listen to a clown like Rush Limbaugh that I heard Tom Scheer say. And I beg to differ when a commentator from MSNBC says I get a dribble down my leg while listening to Barack Obama. But, I mean, all kidding aside here, my concern is the $30 million for the Marsh Mouse, the $600 million for green vehicles. I mean, if we can go through this, guys, This is a pork-laden bill. Well, really all we had to do was cut taxes.
Well,
that would have done much more effectiveness. And how about...
I'm not going to cut you off. First of all, tax cuts. We had tax cuts from George W. Bush. What did that do? He spent the money before he saw if he had it. When is somebody going to raise, even a Democrat, going to raise the connection between the massive federal deficit increase and this financial fix we're in now? They're not completely unrelated. Tax cuts don't work to the extent that you're suggesting, caller, because supply-side economics don't work to the extent that you're suggesting. I'm telling you. I will agree with you here. They did roll a lot of this into a big mishmash with a spending bill and stimulus combined, and I'm not any more comfortable with that than you are.
I don't see the stimulus at all.
Oh, there's plenty of stimulus in there, but I don't know why it had to be part of a spending bill.
It's just taking tax money and give it to people out of work. That's not stimulus.
It is. Actually, it has a multiplier of 1.79. The highest multiplier you get from any of your stimulus spending is for unemployment insurance benefits.
Even if you take one component, the direct aid to states, which will therefore not have to lay off workers. That's one. Direct aid to school districts, which will not have to lay off teachers and other support personnel. Right there. That's just something right off the top of the list.
I would agree with him, though, when he gets like $16 million to like Acorn, which was hit up for tax or for voter fraud in the past and things of that sort.
Acorn self-reported the voter fraud, which was not committed by Acorn, but by freelance personnel they hired from a temporary aid.
Give it to a group like that.
That's how it's always done.
Let's get into the politics of it. Isn't that how bills get passed? Whether you are Republicans or Democrats, people try to put a little Christmas tree and they keep putting ornaments on it. And with every ornament you put on, you get X number of votes.
And that's why, in the long run, this is going to have a short run benefit for the public. I agree with Ralph. But in the long run, someone is going to have to pay for this. This is not a freebie. These monies are going to have to be paid for by the next 2-3 generations. This is a huge, huge hit, and ultimately could be inflationary, and folks down the road are going to pay for this.
But again, for Republicans now to talk about the downside of a deficit and suddenly to become deficit hawks in the wake of 8 years of George Bush with the way that the deficit has grown.
I agree. I can't defend it.
And by the way, if it was the other side, the Democrats would be doing the same thing.
Sure, I can't defend it. I mean, the crap that came out of the Bush spending that came out of the Bush administration is so un-Republican, it drives me nuts.
Ralph, question to you. Is there any realistic way that legislation could ever be passed without the whole concept of the Christmas tree? Some pork being put onto every bill. That's how the system works.
Let me think about it. No. See, the problem with the political process is it's just that. It's a political process. So when you evaluate these bills, and this is a huge one. I mean, this is a monumental bill. When you evaluate them, you got to say, on the whole, is it materially a really good bill with some nonsense added on to make it politically attractive or not? And I think when you look at this, if you take any sort of data-based analysis, it's a good bill. It's going to help the nation. It's needed right now. And Barack Obama tried to do it on a bipartisan basis. So you got to support it.
We'll take more calls when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. Talking politics tonight from Chicago, as we do each and every Sunday night, wherever you're listening, from coast to coast and border to border. Nice to have you with us tonight. From Boise, Idaho to Bakersfield, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. Let's go to Northern Idaho, where Dave is listening to us on KXLY out of Spokane. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, I was wondering if either one of your guests read the stimulus package. It seems to me we're trying to pass this thing so quick and we didn't even read it.
I didn't read all 700-plus pages of it, but I read a substantial amount online yesterday and today. The Chicago Tribune and the Washington Post did a great job explaining it in pretty good terms.
Yeah, Ralph? Ditto.
But the devils are in the details, and you're going to miss a lot of things that really we should have took 3 or 4 weeks to go over.
There is no question about that, and we should say that in many state legislatures around the United States, not unlike Congress— this is standard operating procedure. This is not new. This is startling because we're talking about $787 billion, but there are far less numbers that are voted on routinely. And, Judy, take us inside. You spent many years as a member of the General Assembly. Take us inside what happens in the closing days of a session when a lawmaker, whether it's Republican or Democrat, you're a Republican, but I would assume that in many cases your caucus was not that much different than the Democratic caucus when it came to decision-making on really important issues that the lawmakers might not have been up to speed on.
Right, and they would always be waiting to the last day, because the last day you would just wear everybody down, and you'd pass these things at 2, 3, 4 in the morning after people had been there all day and, you know, maybe weeks before, and were just tired. And ultimately, you'd both parties would pack all sorts of crap into these things. I mean, God, I would just hate to think of how many times I voted for band uniforms for some high school that I didn't know about because it was never discussed. We had maybe 10 minutes to see a bill that was gargantuan.
And what happens, again, be brutal now, what happens if a lawmaker stands up and makes a big stink about it? What happens to that lawmaker?
Generally speaking, they get punished. They get punished. As I say, I always did well because
They get punished because something they want later will not be supported by the guy who wanted the band uniform.
They may not get put on a committee. They may not get a bill passed. A bill could go into committee and die there very nicely or be picked up by a sponsor that'll kill it. I mean, there's a thousand ways to punish someone, and you can do very, very effectively.
Ralph, you observe the system as well in a number of states. Add to that description of what happens when lawmakers are voting on major pieces of legislation as it relates to fiscal issues.
Well, I'm just going to quote someone, a state senator here in Illinois, State Senator Reverend James T. Meeks, who runs a large Baptist church. And I was upset over a piece of a bill that got tampered with, shall we say, to expand a credit that would only benefit really rich people. And this was a bill that was supposed to help primarily low and middle income families. And Reverend Senator Meek said, "Ralph," because he's got that kind of voice, "you need to calm down and understand that whenever the legislative train leaves the station, it always gets loaded up with the rich man's baggage." And that's about right. I mean, at some point, things get added onto a bill. They're usually not big in dollar amounts.
Who was the senator?
Although he could also say it also frequently gets loaded up with the poor man's responsibilities as well.
Oh, sure. Who was the United States Senator from Vermont 30 years ago? Aiken, his last name. What was his first
George.
Name? George Aiken. George Aiken left the Senate, his retirement, and he said, "I have sinned. I have voted for things I did not want, nor did I believe in them, but I did it to play ball so I could get, at the end of the week, what I thought was good for the country. I have to give something to get something. George Aiken said that. I forgot his first name.
And that's the way it works, and everybody can decry it, but that's the way it works.
Yeah, I voted for some dogs in my life, but not horrible dogs, but they were little mongrel things.
Joe in Schaumburg, Illinois, listening to us on WLS. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. Hi, panel. I want to talk about the stimulus bill,
yes.
The bipartisan part of it,
yeah.
Specifically. The Republicans are crying about the bipartisan part of it. What's Barack Obama supposed to do? Kiss their feet? Look, they're not going to go along with the guy. But, you know, they should come to reality. They lost, and they lost big. I mean, for John McCain to say a couple of days ago, well, you know, he didn't reach across party lines. And, I mean, isn't this the same character that said that after he lost that he would work with the president to try to move this country forward? I mean, come on. This is ridiculous. The mistake that the president is making is reaching out to them because they're not – they're not going to cooperate. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Well,
Boehner, with those theatrics that he had the other day, that he threw it on the floor in the Senate floor, you know, the Senate floor, when he said, "Well, we haven't read this bill," then how does he know that there's pork in it?
Well, I agree with you. To the victor go the spoils. That's why we have elections in the country.
That's
and
right.
And although it isn't perhaps politically polite to say, "Hey, listen, we won. Now we're going to do it our way." I mean, that's a pretty hard-edged way of doing it.
But
the reality is, if you offer the olive branch and people are not accepting it, then frankly, you know what? You deserve what you get, and it may be nada.
I would be more concerned.
You're going to tell me they're going to cooperate, Bruce? You're going to tell me they're going to cooperate with the president in his 4 years?
I do believe that they will cooperate. They will cooperate when there is the first inkling that this stimulus package is working.
Healthcare? Absolutely not.
I would be more concerned that the kumbaya type effect that the president is offering to the Republicans, and I'm grateful for that. Anytime when you're the loser and someone offers you something, hey, you know, I'll take what I can get and walk with half a loaf. But I would be concerned with that type of attitude when he has to deal with the Russians and when he has to deal with the
Persians. Oh, I don't
think
there's any question
and stuff like that.
The two are unrelated. Judy, do you really think? Do you?
No, they are not unrelated.
They are so completely unrelated.
They are not unrelated.
It is laughable. It is laughable how unrelated they are.
It's an attitude.
An attitude. Do you mean that? Yes, he has an attitude to help this country by trying to build a bipartisan effort.
I'm all for that, but at the same time.
Do you think for 1 minute that the president of the United States, in this case, this president, Barack Obama, is going to try and build cooperation with our enemies to our detriment?
I'm concerned in terms of trying to negotiate
Let Judy respond.
That kind of a feeling, as he tries to negotiate and hold out the olive branch and say, look, let's make have a peaceful solution.
So you equate the Republicans with the Iraqi or with the Iranians?
I'm just saying let's use some common sense in how we deal with all of this.
Well, it appears that we've touched a nerve here. Let's go to Bakersfield, California, Kern County, one of the conservative counties in Central California. Nice to hear from you, Len. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? Hey, Tom, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
Have you ever employed anybody?
Yes, I have.
What state?
Illinois.
Illinois. Well, I got a plan for you. Come out to California and employ somebody. I'm a small business guy. I'm probably what you would call the rich. I've got myself and two guys working. I own a pest control company here in Bakersfield, California. Small. Mm-hmm. I'm a small company, but I make over $250,000 a year. It takes me 40 forms to fill out to hire one guy, okay? All right? Now, if, you know, the budget crunch that California's in right now, they're going to raise taxes. They're talking about raising taxes. Well, it costs me, I'm looking at my payroll taxes right now, to cut one guy a check, pay him every 2 weeks, and he's making under $1,000 in 2 weeks, it cost me, as an employer, $150 in payroll taxes.
Well, let me stop you right
there. Hold on.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
Let me just say
I just thought I would let Len finish.
And the way the economy is, I'm going to probably lay off one guy. Yeah. So you tell me how not lowering taxes is not a stimulus.
Because if the taxes are lowered right now, taxes on your company are lowered right now, you're going to tell me that you'll take that savings and you will not lay off that guy.
Exactly.
Okay, now, I think that you are what's right with the United States. Okay, you are what's right. Most companies, when they have extra money on the bottom line, they still cut. And the best example of that is a company called General Electric. They're in trouble now. Like most companies, they're not in trouble. They're making much less. Take a look at when they were in the halcyon days of the late 80s through the 90s. They were making money hand over fist, record earnings in some years, and they still kept laying people off. Why? Because they could. Most corporations are not like you, the little guy. They'll take that savings and they'll put it in their CEO's pocket and they'll put it in the stockholder's pocket.
But Tom, Obama, okay, Biden, I don't know what definition they consider the wealthy, but I've heard ranges from 150, 200,000, 250. I don't know where that is, okay, because they changed their mind a few times.
Well,
From a
wealth standpoint, this is Ralph, by the way. From a wealth standpoint, you're in the top 5% of all Americans.
Yeah, and I top trust 5%. Me, when I, trust that, me when I tell you.
That means 95% of the taxpayers, which means married filing jointly, 95% of the taxpayers in America earn less than you. Think about that.
Trust me, when I tell you this, I am not rich. I've got workers' comp insurance. I've got general liability insurance. There's all kinds of outlays that
Len,
I have.
Len, let me clarify something if I can, though. You said that you made $250,000. Is that your take home or is that your profit for your corporation?
That's a little bit of that. Most of it's profit. So my profitability is about $160,000. That's after paying everything. So I'm up. It just depends. It's fluctuating, because of the economy. So, you know, I just kind of give you a ballpark figure in there. Now, look,
let me ask you one other question, and it might have been in one of the Bakersfield papers over the last couple of days. Have they said to you, have you read anywhere how much of the federal stimulus package is going to go back to the state of California?
Man,
and
you
from
know
the
what?
State
I
of California,
just,
how much of that trickles down to Bakersfield?
Well, you know, that's going to be a good question. Let me give you for instance here.
15
seconds.
We have
gas, you know, oil has gone down, what is it, $38 a barrel. We're in a, you know, we have Elk Hills Naval, it used to be Elk Hills Naval Reserve until Al Gore sold it. But anyway, we had the largest naval oil reserve in the United States here. Bakersfield or Kern County is a huge oil producing.
Len, you're fading into the woodwork as we go to a break. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly.
Thanks.
From Fayetteville, North Carolina to Phoenix, Arizona, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway on America's Great Radio Stations and Sirius XM Satellite Radio. And 1-800-723-8289 is the phone number. By the way, in talking about the stimulus package, you will recall that last week on this program, we talked about an amendment that had passed the Senate, which prohibited the use of any stimulus money to assist museums, casinos, aquariums, zoos, sports stadiums, golf courses, and everything else. As a museum president, it was a little impossible for me to believe that 73 members of the United States Senate actually believed that you should put museums in the same category as casinos and golf courses. So in the conference committee, they did see the wisdom of their ways. And so in this particular case, the stimulus package does prohibit the use of any money to go into casinos or golf courses or sports stadiums, but it does separate out, also zoos, it includes zoos, but it does separate out museums and other cultural arts entities, which I think is a good idea. It's not only a good idea for me as a museum president when I'm not hosting this program, I will focus attention on that, but also I think it's good policy because museums create a stimulus and they create jobs just like everyone else.
It's
and
true.
So
they're
we,
good for kids. It's true. Good for families.
Cities have to survive as business and entertainment centers, and museums are part of that. I heard Schumer talking about what the arts mean to New York. Forget New York. What about Springfield, Illinois, or Chicago, or Boise, Idaho, or so? It's a big deal.
And good projects wherever they are deserve to be supported. And I also believe that that when those decisions are made closer to the actual purpose of the dollars, I think the decisions can be made wiser. So whether it is a mayor making decisions or governors or local representatives,
well, I just find it terrible that poor kids don't get a chance to go to museums because the cost of getting in has just become prohibitive. It's just like you pay for these horrible stadiums publicly, which ought not to ever be done, and then you charge so much that families can't go. I mean, for God's sake.
But there are, at least in the state of Illinois, there are free days. Tied to any state funding, there is a free day which goes as well it should.
Not enough, though. I mean, and so any help we can be on that front, I think that's worthwhile.
Judy Bartopinka joins us. She is our Republican. She is a former elected official. She was elected 3 times as the state treasurer, the first woman elected statewide as a member of the Republican Party. And also,
Don Clark Netcheck.
No, as a Republican.
Oh, as a Republican, yeah. Yeah, okay.
And she ran for governor against Rod Blagojevich. She's also a Republican committeewoman.
No, committeeman.
They call him committeeman, even though you can wear a dress. And or a pants skirt. And on Thursday night, she is having her big annual fundraiser. It is the Lincoln Day Dinner. February 19th at 6:30. That's at Clem's Banquet Hall in beautiful Lyons, Illinois. It's $25, and yours truly has been invited to be the speaker. So I can literally bring my vacation pictures?
Absolutely.
What are they expecting me to talk about?
Well, they want to talk about early television because of your interest in there, the museum, the broadcast museum, and also the fact that you have run these kind of programs which have been nonpartisan. You've gone to conventions.
Time.
You've dealt with both political parties. Hey, you got a wealth of information, Bruce.
I know a lot. And some of it I can actually tell. Maybe I'll tell it.
You could drop some names like Rod Blagojevich is going to do?
I'll drop a few names. Ooh. By the way, if you'd like to attend, you can still sell more tickets, right?
Absolutely.
708-351-0349. 708-351-0349. What are we having for dinner?
Right, and it's we open it to everybody.
You're having a good dinner, too.
The food is really good, and we open it up to Republicans, Democrats, Independents.
Let me throw something out there. You can get a direct flight to Chicago, O'Hare, or Midway Airport, just about anywhere in the United States. People from around the country listening to Beyond the Beltway come in for the dinner.
For my dinner.
Stay a couple days in the Chicago area and see this great city.
And Midway Airport is really reasonably close here to Lyons, so it's
very
just
good.
Somebody out listening in
Washington,
you all come out.
Can fly in.
That's exactly
you all come out.
Also joining us this evening is Tom Scheer. He is a noted talk show host. He's also a media consultant, advisor to a number of people who need media help, and also a great reporter and a great broadcaster in his own right. And also joining us this evening is Ralph Martiri. He is the executive director of the Center for Tax and Budget Accountability. He watches not only in the state of Illinois. Do you have entities in all 50 states, Ralph? What's the structure of
We are located here, but we do work on federal policy and in a couple of other states. So we're doing some projects in Ohio and some other states right now where we're helping them with their education funding and related systems. And we're working on Social Security reform nationally. We've always been involved with one or more states besides Illinois. But since we're based here and since there's so much to do in the great state of Illinois, we've had a lot of work
right here at home.
You said at the beginning of the program, for those that did not hear it, you said that those who live in Illinois really are behind the curve because they are bogged down by all of the skullduggery that goes into the politics in the state of Illinois, and that people in other states tend to deal with things more seriously. I mean, the really big issues, they may address it more seriously. I'm sort of paraphrasing what you had to say. But my point is, as you study state government, which states appear to be a little more serious and maybe are on to some innovative things that the rest of the country should maybe take a look at?
Well, there's a number of states that really work hard on good public policy. I mean, and a lot of them are our neighbors, by the way. Wisconsin, Minnesota, very great states, known for good leadership in both parties, known for being innovative in public policy. Michigan at least tries to do things every now and again, but I don't think they've had a good economy in Michigan since the 70s, so they're struggling a little bit there. Ohio has had some attempts at leadership. The new governor in Ohio has put forth a whole new way to fund education, which we are analyzing right now. It's an evidence-based model. So
Indiana
has had some good leadership too. I mean, really,
Mitch Daniels.
Yeah, in the Midwest, Illinois is unique in a lot of ways. We are by far and away the largest economy, or the fifth largest economy of any state. We have all these natural advantages with a financial hub, a transportation hub, 9 major universities, all this other stuff, and yet our economic growth has lagged the Midwest and the nation for 20 years. And we really, because of our almost off-point approach to policy, it's politics, 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 then maybe a little policy at the end, can never seem to really get things done. But we do have an opening here with Governor Quinn. I think Governor Quinn will try. He's a wonk. We'll try to get some things done
man.
For the state.
He's a decent,
yeah.
man.
A decent guy.
You know,
a
his heart's in the right place. He's going to have trouble, and they're going to pick him off in 2 years. But
I hope not. You know, I don't like this business in any state where there's the political royalty. I thought Hillary Clinton acted as if she were entitled to the White House. I think in the state of Illinois, Lisa Madigan is acting as if she's entitled to the governorship, or at least her supporters are. And I don't think that's fair. I think Pat Quinn is a great man, and I think that people should be able to elect him not because somebody else does or doesn't want him in there.
Let us go to Chicago, where Anthony is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. First of all, I believe that this stimulus package will not create wealth in America, and that with Republicans being obstinate, this is just a case of low-tax capitalist versus high-tax socialist. But in the last hour, I heard a lot derogatory said about the Bush economy. And I just wanted to bring to everybody's attention that business investment during Bush's terms was at a record, as well as corporate profits. Unemployment was 4.5% in 2006. Between May 2003 and May 2006, asset values rose by $13 trillion. And the receipts to the Treasury rose double digits every year to a record $2.85 trillion in 2007. The government had more than enough money, and they failed not to spend. Oh, and there was also a
Anthony, as your
52-month job growth.
As you're, Anthony, as you're speaking, you probably cannot hear Ralph Martiri's head going back and forth saying no, no, no. So I'm going to put him on the radio and have him respond to what you said.
Yeah, first of all, your revenue numbers are simply wrong. The revenue most recent year, the last complete fiscal year for the federal government, the revenue numbers were significantly below the $2.5 trillion total expenditures. So I think they were below by close to $500 billion because they utilized the Social Security surplus for current operation needs. It was not unique to George W. It's been done for a while, but still, revenues have been falling way below the federal budget throughout his administration, number one. Number two, his administration has the worst job creation record of any administration, period. Just the worst. But, and on capitalism, I just got to get to that. You know, you're wrong. I mean, the guy that invented capitalism is my biggest hero, Adam Smith. And he flat out said, if you want to have fair and responsive taxation that works in a capitalist economy, you need progressive in taxation that puts a bigger burden on affluent folks than it does on middle or low income folks. Period.
We're going to move on.
Capitalism 101.
Mark in Austin, Texas, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, boy. A lot to say. I would say this to both of your guests and all those in Congress perhaps that might be listening, if not out on a sailboat somewhere, patting themselves on the back. It has never been, it never will be, that the government can pass a stimulus bill on our backs, which is what we're talking about here, not only our backs, but our children's backs and our grandchildren's backs and virtually our assets in the country to create an economy. All I've heard is jobs. I've heard nothing about production. We've lost in a decade 80% of our manufacturing capability in this country. And I don't think Americans are in the mood to hear we live in a global economy, ergo we should go ahead and ship off our heart and soul and our guts to foreign countries only to be turned into perpetual consumers up until a certain point when we can no longer consume anymore. And you can collect all the tax revenues you want to. At the core of the issue, at the very core of the issue is we are in debt. We have been in debt for decades, and we have a Congress who continues not to address the issue of the debt, which has to do with indebted hands, people printing money out of thin air and charging us interest for it.
Mark, I'm going to put you on hold. You ask a good point. We've got a couple of people that are saying they want to respond to you, and we will engage you. So stay right on the line, 1-800-723-8289. Mark, listening to us on KLBJ in Austin, Texas. We'll be back with us as well when we roll on from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
Experience it and win with Tempur-Pedic. If you've been waiting for the absolute best time to try a life-changing Tempur-Pedic Swedish sleep system, this is it. Visit a participating retail store today and get your game piece for a chance to win $10,000 just for trying a Tempur-Pedic mattress. Simply call, click, or visit a participating retailer near you today to find out how. Call 1-800-433-2720 or visit Tempur-Pedic.com/experience. That's 1-800-433-2720 or Tempur-Pedic.com/experience. For official rules, go to www.experienceitandwin.com. Contest ends 3809. Offer void where
With its unique combination of high resale value and 3-year 36,000-mile no-cost maintenance, the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper is a smart buy. You could say it delivers fiscally prudent, environmentally sensitive, flat-out, full-on, go-for-broke, no-holds-barred, white-knuckle, go-kart handling, motoring excitement starting at $19,200. Or you could just say it's a smart buy. Learn more at MiniUSA.com.
For maintenance details, visit MiniUSA.com. 37 Highway 28 City MPG for Mini Cooper hardtop with manual transmission. Preliminary estimate subject to change. MSRP includes destination and handling. Excludes license, registration, taxes, and options.
From Grand Rapids, Michigan to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, on to Tallahassee, Florida and Albany, Georgia. Nice to have you with us wherever you're listening from coast to coast this evening. Mark is standing by in Austin, Texas. Let's do us on KLBJ. And he threw out some red meat here, and our guest, so Ralph Martiri, has a comment, as does Tom. But, Ralph, you want to follow through? Tom, go ahead. You go first.
All right. Well, I just wanted to say something that's very important for the caller to consider, is the word deficit. You just have to look at the budget deficit and what happened during the Bush years. the spending that even a Republican Judy Bartapinka here has identified.
Overspending.
The spending was out of control. And I think that, you know, you mentioned we're a country of debtors, and that is true. Consumer spending, which is not the president's responsibility, was out of control. People buying things on credit cards. Those days are over. All right. All these stores closing. It's terrible. People losing jobs. Honestly, I think it's awful. But at some point, you got to shake out the tree. We were spending money we didn't have. And unfortunately, the president of the United States did that for 8 long years.
Mark.
Well, I would just like to say something, though. First of all, to begin with, let me be very clear from my particular vantage point. I am not a Republican, and I am not a Democrat. I am an American, so the left-right thing doesn't work for me. And the first thing
I didn't say left-right. I'm just giving you facts.
It doesn't matter. It's not. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. And the bottom line is, and you didn't touch on this, there's two things at work here. We are borrowing. We have been borrowing, and it's been going nuts since the early 70s, and we've lived on credit that long. And the other thing is, since the early 70s, and more exacerbated in the last decade or so, has been the issue of driving jobs, manufacturing, real jobs, the real heart and soul of America, out of the country. And the third thing is, a Democrat president named Bill Clinton is the one that signed Senate legislation that made it possible for bankers, who shouldn't even be in this conversation and who should be looked at with a very jaundiced eye by politicians who weren't so worried about being reelected, and the American people who allow them to continue pandering as they are, to sign a bill that made it possible for, it's not bad mortgages that are hurting the country right now, it's trillions of debt that they're not telling people about that really constitutes nothing more than stacks of worthless paper. So what say you, sir?
I want to ask Ralph a follow-up question to what your point about jobs, and that is, in this economic stimulus package where allegedly 3 million jobs are going to be created, how many of those jobs are real jobs? What type of jobs are they, Ralph?
Well, on the infrastructure jobs, obviously, you have the construction jobs, and then after the construction period is done, and construction is one of the highest-paying sectors in the economy.
Right.
It's even
very
higher
male,
by the way, so let's worry about the ladies, because okay. Most of them are not, you know, going to be manning a jackhammer.
They could if they wanted.
They could.
Go ahead, Ralph.
But they're good, high-paying jobs. They're even higher-paying than manufacturing jobs. They eventually go away, except for the maintenance jobs thereafter, but then you have operational jobs. The investments in health care and education, actually the longer-term spending investments, those are ones that have an even higher multiplier, Bruce, because what happens is they are not only jobs that give you an immediate benefit by having the salaries maintained and spent through the economy, but they also put Americans back to work. If you get access to health care when you wouldn't have it otherwise,
but I
stay in the
one
job.
One of the things that Mark was talking about, I think, was how many of those jobs actually produce something, make something, a product, or are they mostly services? Is that part of your problem or question, Mark?
I do. Hang on, if I just may, real quick here, I just would say this. It just seems to me that there's an awful lot of dancing around that goes on, and the bottom line is a very simple one. We live in a country where the simplicity and the elegance of our experience is manifest in our Constitution, and we have people who are up there passing bills. Everybody's admitting to this, talking about, well, I got to do this to get that and get the other, and compromises. The road to hell is paved full of it. And we're leading ourselves farther and farther and farther away from any possibility of our children enjoying any fraction of the life that we have right now. And it all stems
from
debt and creating money out of thin air and destroying our real economy, which is our manufacturing.
You have agreement on the table with that point. We're going to move on to Knoxville, Tennessee. Jeff is listening to us on WNOX. Go ahead.
Bruce, I want to ask one question. First of all, Judy, was your mother's name Ruth?
Pardon me?
Was your mother's name Ruth?
No. Her name was Lillian.
Okay. Wrong Judy. Okay.
Well, you know, we spell our name differently, too. I spell with two A's, B-A-A-R, like you think sheep, you know, bar, not
okay.
Two R's.
Okay. All right. Fine. Bruce, I thoroughly concur with the guy from Texas, and I also want to know what kind of Kool-Aid all of the politicians are drinking. There are two real simple ways to take care of stimulating the economy and getting the chaff off the wheat, and that is, number one, it could have been done for a lot less by taking every legitimate U.S. citizen and giving each one $1 million. That'd be about $310 million instead of 800 and some billion. They, in turn, would stimulate the economy by supporting those businesses that should be in business, and the ones that shouldn't should be gone. The mortgages would be taken care of. Now let's get down to reality. The reality is, instead of using the ostrich head in the sand syndrome, let's go to what really could stimulate the economy, and most politicians, in fact, as virtually all of them, do not want to look at, and the fair tax would do the whole trick and would stimulate the economy and give the control back to the people and get rid of this cockamamie bull spit that we're dealing with.
All right, let's go to Ralph. Let him respond.
Is your fair tax the national sales tax thing?
No, sir. Once again, people are trying to put it off. The fair tax is not the national sales tax. It's not a flat tax. It's a consumption tax. So therefore, and you guys want to call it a sales tax, but the consumption tax puts the burden upon those people that want to buy the heavy costed items. They will pay, and there will be no loopholes. There's no way that that cannot be fruitful for the
10-second answer to Ralph Martiri, and then we've got to go.
Really quick, that wouldn't work. It's actually regressive. It would hurt most people, and it's not the way you're supposed to tax in a capitalist economy. And number two, U.S. workers have actually increased their productivity over the last 10 years by about 30% while their wages have gone down. So the problem isn't the worker here. It's the people running the businesses. They're the ones that need to be held accountable.
Amen.
That was Ralph Martiri, the tax expert, not the band leader. He is the executive director of the Center for Tax Budget Accountability. Ralph, thanks very much for joining us on Beyond the Beltway. Our Democrat has been Tom Scheer. Our Republican has been Judy Bartopinka. Again, Thursday night, if you're in the Chicagoland area, the number 708-351-0349. It's the Lincoln Day Dinner in beautiful Lyons, Illinois. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Ben Stewart for their assistance in the production of this program. I'm Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.